Since its beginnings in 2013, in response to the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the killing of Trayvon Martin, Black Lives Matter, the organization, the movement, the phrase, has elicited some sort of response by politicians, the media, and folks in their communities. Some people stake Black Lives Matter signs proudly in their front yards. Others decry it as a hate group. But in Utah, where the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute reports Black people make up less than 2% of the population, is Black Lives Matter more than a hashtag? This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means.
Welcome to Black Lives Matter Utah. This is your first meeting. You should know that 20 people will filter in the next half hour.
To learn more about the group and how it operates in Utah, I attended the Black Lives Matter Utah chapter meeting this week at the Glendale branch of the Salt Lake City Public Library. More than 30 people trickled in throughout the evening. Some had never attended before, and the rest were there to discuss the group's advocacy plans and activities for the summer. Everyone had their own reason for getting involved, though.
Why did I come to Black Lives Matter? Well, because I'm Black. No, really, I met Trayvon Martin's mom, and that kind of sparked it.
I'm from Mexico, and I come from a family with some undocumented family members, and so I'm very familiar with what racism is like, but I have a feeling that I need to be here to support my Black brothers and sisters, so yeah.
I joined this movement because honestly, I was inspired by my brother. He lives in Virginia, and he has been doing a lot of work with Black Lives Matter for the last couple of years, and I just was sick of being a keyboard warrior. I was done, so I wanted to be proactive.
Spearheading the group is Lex Scott. I sat down with her to talk about the philosophy behind Black Lives Matter and how she came to establish the group in Utah.
I started an organization called the United Front Civil Rights Organization in 2014. We protested all over the world, including Ferguson. And, you know, I've been holding meetings at a restaurant called Maxwell's since 2014. And I'd post in the Facebook page and I would just basically say, okay, come to brunch, let's start this chapter. And then either two people would show up or no one would show up. And I did that for years and years and years. And for years, I was like the only Black person at the Utah Against Police Brutality protest. So finally, you know, someone said, why don't you create an event in the Facebook page? And I was like, fine, I'll create an event for you. No one will show up. And I created the event, and then 200 people showed up.
Were you surprised?
Yeah. I was like, are you serious? All I had to do is create an event. That is so frustrating. But now, you know, it makes me cry a lot because we have so many members. We have too many members, you know. And then last weekend, we met with the leaders of Black Lives Matter at Maxwell's. And it did make me cry because people showed up to one of my meetings at Maxwell's. So, yeah, that's it. We've been going strong 4 years.
Maybe you can describe this movement, because it seems a little unique to me. You know, there's the Black Lives Matter umbrella nationwide, but I don't know, some words you would use to describe it.
We believe, this chapter believes, that Black Lives Matter is a movement and not an organization. We are not part of the Black Lives Matter national network. We have kind of a different mindset. So, for example, the Ferguson protesters, the people on the ground on Canfield and Florissant Avenue, we believe that it is a movement. And there are certain people that believe it is an organization. We wrote our own rules for the chapter. The movement itself has several purposes: to stop police brutality, to hold police accountable for their actions, and have transparency from elected officials. We believe also in making white people uncomfortable in their privilege. You know, if we're blocking a street, it's because, you know, we can invite racists to come to our Black Lives Matter meetings. They're not going to show up. So we go to where they feel comfortable, where they feel safe, and we cause massive disruptions. Because if we feel uncomfortable and unsafe existing in Black skin, we are going to make people who feel comfortable and safe in their own skin feel uncomfortable and unsafe.
I imagine there are a handful of responses from white people when you organize in this way.
You know, we have so many white allies in Utah. I myself am half white. I have a black daughter and a white passing son. My mom is white. My husband is white. And so, you know, we have hundreds of white members who support the movement and who help us with the chapter. And it's not about racism. It's not about bigotry. It is about looking at systematic inequities in this country and tearing them apart. There is oppression. There is systematic oppression, mass incarceration, the school-to-prison pipeline, police brutality, police profiling, inequity in the school system, redlining, etc. And so we basically take all those things, we make the world look at them more closely, and we try to destroy them.
Well, you mentioned that Black Lives Matter Utah chapter has kind of created its own identity. Can you talk about specific issues in Utah that your chapter addresses that might be different from other states?
Well, Utah only has 2% of a black population here. So we're very, very tiny. And what we've seen forever, obviously I was bullied as a kid here, is I have a lot of parents, whether they're interracial adoptees or they're black parents and they have their black children being bullied in schools. So that is my passion, is helping the black bullied children in Utah and ending that. We obviously have Elijah Smith, who was just murdered by West Valley Police. We have Lonnie, who was just killed by Salt Lake PD. We had Dylan Taylor killed here. He's white. James Barker was killed here. He's white. Yes, we fight for white police brutality victims as well. You know, there's a store in Cedar City selling Confederate flag, racist bumper stickers. We are an all-in-one civil rights organization. So any racism that we hear about, we're going to tackle it in Utah.
Can you compare this movement to the civil rights movement of the 60s or other black-led movements in history?
In the 60s, because my father grew up in the Jim Crow South in Amarillo, Texas, and he was also an activist. And in the 60s, we had Jim Crow laws that separated black people from attending white schools, using the same bathrooms as white people, using the same water fountains, entering in the same entrances as white people to restaurants and entertainment venues, and also fighting police brutality because the police were lynching us back then. And in 2018, our schools are still segregated. You know, they draw the school lines according to income levels, and we believe that they are just as segregated as during Jim Crow. Martin Luther King blocked roads back then, just like we block roads. He blocked the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Martin Luther King was arrested 30 times for protesting police brutality. You know, we believe that in the 60s, they would lynch us by hanging us from trees. In 2018, they lynch us by shooting us in the streets. I don't believe that anything has changed since the 60s but the weather. They passed that 1964 Civil Rights Act, but it has never been enforced. And there are so many racist situations that people tag me in and show me. And in my mind, I'm like, you need to invoke the Civil Rights Act.
How do you think it hasn't been enforced?
Well, for example, we just saw that situation in which the two men were arrested for sitting in a Starbucks right. for 2 minutes. And if I was there at the time, I would have said, according to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, I have the right to be served just like the other white people that are in here. And I would have filed a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit against them. I believe that we need to sue more as a people. We need to invoke that Civil Rights Act. We are not given equal rights. We are still not paid the same. We are still denied housing. And so many of us are conditioned to not talk about racism. No one wants to talk about racism. It's so uncomfortable for people. And they think it will just go away if you don't talk about it, like cancer. Like, I have cancer. Don't talk about it. you're just making it worse. No, we have to talk about racism and racial issues.
The current argument is it shuts down the conversation. Do you think that it does that by saying, hey, what you're doing is racist? Can you continue to engage with that person afterwards?
Well, and that's another thing. I'll see people online like, oh, Lex, you're so racist. I'm not joining your movement. And, you know, there's this assumption that we need white people. We need white people to be successful. We have to have their permission and their acceptance. And we don't. We are Black-led. We are capable. Black people are educated, intelligent, and capable of running our own movements. And if white people come to the movement, then they are there as a place of support and not to lead us. And they shouldn't just assume, okay, your help is so needed. No, I'm not out here trying to recruit more white people. We have white people raining from the skies like a snowstorm, okay? We're trying to recruit more Black people to the chapter, more Latin people, more Pacific Islanders, more Asian people, more LGBT people. And when the white people come, we are very welcoming. We love our white allies in Utah. But if someone's going to enter into a conversation with me about race, they need to definitely understand I'm the expert. I define my own lived experiences. And it's not a debate. You know, a lawyer wouldn't go to a doctor's office and say, you know what, I'm going to tell you how to do this surgery right now. No.
Well, something that I noticed at your meeting this week, your leadership team is Black women, and the movement was started by Black women as well. Why is that so important to you?
Black women have been on the front lines from the beginning, and, you know, it's crazy. They just gravitate to the movement. And we have a few Black men. We have Mike, and we have Jay, and we have Malik. Malik came last night, and I'm trying to recruit more Black men. But Black men have been noticeably missing from the movement, and there are a lot of reasons for that. When I ask them, most of them say they're sick of fighting for civil rights. They're just tired of it. And I think we're all tired of it, but I'm the one who said, let's go ahead and end our oppression in this lifetime. You have to be able to picture that. Most Black people can't even picture. I'm like, can you picture America without racism? And they're like, no, don't aim too high, Lex. That's how high I'm aiming. I want an end to racism in America in my lifetime. And I work really hard to achieve it.
Let's talk about some of the things that the chapter is doing. So you mentioned protests, and something that I do want to ask you about in regards to those, you make a very clear point to the participants of these rallies and protests that they will not be violent. Why is that something that you stress so much?
You know what? We don't have to be violent. We don't allow anyone to destroy property in the chapter. We don't allow anyone to incite violence. We believe in self-defense only. You'll often see me open carrying a semi-automatic 45 caliber weapon at my protests. And I do that for two reasons. Black people have the right to bear arms. And the second reason is when Black people are killed, whether they have a weapon on them or a knife or, in Darian Hunt's case, a sword, you know, the media is quick to say, well, he was carrying a weapon, and they dismiss the officer involved shooting. So I like for people to see Black people open carrying weapons, because just as white people do, we have the constitutional right to bear arms. And I'd like to kind of normalize that. But if anyone is caught inciting violence in our chapter, they will be blocked and removed, and I will testify against them in court. If anyone destroys property, it's the same thing. People have this misconception that Black Lives Matter just starts riots and sets fires. And, you know, in Ferguson, we'd protest for 8 hours, 10 hours. And, you know, they were peaceful protests with music and drums and pizza and 3-year-olds and 85-year-olds. And we had so much fun. And then at the end of the day, when the sun went down, you'd see these people that weren't protesting with you all day come out of nowhere, start breaking things, starting fires. And, you know, the media isn't focusing on our peaceful protest. The media is focusing on these opportunists that came from out of town to destroy property. Those were not Mike Brown's friends. Those are not political activists. Those are people who heard that there are things going on in Ferguson. They drove all the way there just to destroy property and make us look bad. But we also have another theory. You know, you can rebuild every building. You can't bring back Mike Brown. You can't bring back Darian Hunt, Dylan Taylor, James Barker. You know, insurance will pay for a building, but no one will bring back these mothers' sons. So we mourn broken bodies, not broken buildings. But in this chapter, I have congressmen working with me. I have senators. I have mayors. I have police chiefs. They may not all like me, but we've accomplished a lot with diplomacy in this chapter. And I will not tolerate anyone being violent unless it's an act of self-defense.
Okay, rallies and protests, but you do organizing in the community other than that.
Yes. I
know that there was a Black Panther viewing party recently. Maybe you can talk about some of those other things.
Well, we have this new leader named Jay, and he says, you know what? We need to have fun. Civil rights is dark and depressing. And so he's going to organize all these events. We rented out two theaters to take some Black kids to see Black Panther. And it was so much fun that I have not seen Black Panther again, because you cannot go to a theater filled with Black people where we are laughing and singing and dancing the entire movie and just enjoying ourselves and then go see Black Panther with the general public. There's no way. And people are like, yeah, I cannot do it. We also rented out a theater for A Wrinkle in Time. We had Alinda, one of our white ally members, rented out an entire theater so we could take some more Black kids to see that movie. We have Black play dates where the Black kids, they don't see each other very often. So we have them meet in the park and do that. We have outreach initiatives in which we go to the road home, hand out fruit, food, umbrellas, tarps, water, ice, Know Your Rights brochures. We have the election committee that goes to the bus stops and laundromats and registers people to vote. We have the LGBT committee, which is working on the Pride Parade in Salt Lake City right now and working on making more Black and Latin spaces for LGBT members.
You mentioned that you have met with mayors, and in particular, I know you have a working relationship with the Salt Lake City Police Department, and there have been 7 police shootings in Salt Lake County just this year. How do you address those events with Chief Mike Brown from Salt Lake City Police Department? What does the conversation look like?
Mike Brown is the best police chief in the United States of America. I consider him a friend. He makes me mad a lot, but you'll never see another police chief who's actively working to prevent and stop police brutality. So, you know, we've done a lot with Salt Lake PD, and it wasn't just Black Lives Matter. It was Utah Against Police Brutality, the ACLU, the NAACP, Citizens for Police Reform, you know, everything. And all of these activist groups, we basically have implemented de-escalation training, more diversity training, diversity in hiring, body cam footage policies, and we call ourselves the CAG, the Community Activist Group. So, you know, when we see Salt Lake PD shooting people, this is how I see it, because we meet with the higher-ups at Salt Lake PD. And it's kind of like, in Black Lives Matter, I'll tell people not to make threats or not to put racial slurs or something. And every once in a while, someone will do that. And if they do it, it's blamed directly upon me because I'm the leader. That's the first role of management, is everything is your fault. But I do see that Mike Brown goes out there. He gives de-escalation awards to police that don't use their weapon. So I have to say they're not listening to him sometimes. The majority of the officers do. But that officer that shoots first and asks questions later, Mike is really good at working with the activists and working to improve his department. We just need to see Mike fire some of these officers, because Officer Fox, who killed Patrick Harmon, still has a job carrying a weapon, patrolling the streets. It'd be great if Mike Brown would send a message that police brutality wasn't okay. We'll get there.
For 2018, for this year, what are some specific goals and policies that you that you have in mind?
I want to pass something called the Police Accountability and Transparency Act. It would say that every police department has to have 30 hours of de-escalation training a year. Every police department has to have a body cam footage policy that says all body cam footage has to be released within 24 hours of every officer-involved shooting, unedited with sound. I want every police department to have 30 hours of diversity training. Every police officer must be drug tested for steroids.
Across the state?
Across the entire state. Every police department must have a police force that mirrors their community. So if it's 2% Black, I want at least 2% Black police force, 2% Latin, 2% Pacific Islander. And I want every police department to track every person they arrest by their race, age, and gender, so we know and we have proof that they are profiling Black and brown people. So we want live data tracking of every police department. It's called the Police Accountability and Transparency Act. And instead of me going into every individual police department and reforming each one, I just want this legislation passed. And you know what? I could die happy. I want that piece of legislation passed. I want more Black unity in this state. I want the Black Christians to unite with the Black atheists and the Black Mormons to unite with the Black Jewish people. And we do have Black Jewish people. And I want the LGBT community to unite with the Black straight community. And I want the wealthy Black people to unite with the impoverished Black people. In the Black community, there are deep divisions, and especially in Utah. And we find ways to separate ourselves. And until you've like experienced Black unity, like at the Black Panther movie showing, when you do it, experience it, you get addicted to it. And I just want people in this state to, Black people, to join the chapter and help us, because there's something special about this chapter. And it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And we're helping people. We're changing lives. We run a clean show. And we love people of color. So that's the goal. Let's get more.
Seems easy enough.
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, Lex Scott from Black Lives Matter Utah, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Scott referred to the CAG meetings, the Community Activist or Advocates Group, held every other Wednesday at the Public Safety Building with the Salt Lake City Police Department. SLCPD Detective Greg Wilking has been to almost all of those meetings since their inception. Given the perceived tension between the movement and law enforcement, I asked Wilking to reflect on his opinion of Black Lives Matter when SLCPD started meeting with the CAG.
Well, I was concerned about where the movement was coming from. I look at it as our police interactions are with a variety of people on a daily basis, and we have plenty of good interactions. A lot of what happens in a situation that is ends up being a significant incident in the media, a lot of times we have two people involved. We have the police, and then we have the subject that we're dealing with. And our actions are often based on their actions. And so I'm concerned about the accountability of everybody involved, right? The police have to be held accountable for their actions. And when we do something wrong, we should be held to the flame and looked at and scrutinized. But we also have to look at the individuals that we're dealing with and what they're bringing to the table and their actions and their behavior. I was concerned initially about what we were doing. But we were bringing a lot of different groups together that were concerned about issues in the community. And that's how the CAG meeting started. And Black Lives Matter has participated in that meeting ever since.
The CAG was formed in response to the shooting of Abdi Mohammed by Salt Lake City Police in 2016. Wilking said the CAG meetings allowed for better communication during a time of community unrest.
What we found is that when we're yelling at each other across picket lines and protesting and marching, we're not really hearing each other. We need to sit down and have dialogue. And that's what the CAG meetings allow us to do, is have that dialogue with these different groups. You know, we tried to come at it from a very respectful place and try to kind of lay some ground rules that it wasn't going to be yelling and that we were going to give each other opportunity to speak and be heard and really share ideas. And I think that when you start to break down some of the barriers that people initially put up, such as, you know, seeing ourselves as police officers and then, you know, on the other side, people seeing themselves as activists. Like when we start to actually break it down and we become human to each other and we share our experiences in life and we have a common thread, then we start to relate and we start to hear each other. So we laid some ground rules initially to kind of get it started, and we built some bridges. And through that process, we've had a lot of people that have had their opinion changed of what the police department is. And a lot of the problems with the police department is a misunderstanding of why we do what we do. And so I think that educating people and sitting down and talking to them as part of that, educating them really gives them a perspective of why we're doing business the way we're doing it and what we're concerned about.
With so many voices in the room, the different community groups and police officials, I asked Wilking what the activists wanted from the police and the police from the activists.
So they've asked for a variety of different things, which some of it is data to show statistically the contacts that we're having with different minority communities. Some of it is data showing how much we use force on people. And we've been able to provide that. There are some things that they have asked for that, quite frankly, we won't ever be able to give them. I mean, they want certain things that that might even be beyond our control to give to
them.
Can
you give me some examples?
Well, there's they say that they don't want any more people shot. And you know what? We don't want any more people shot. We don't want to have another officer discharged their weapon in the line of duty for the history of this department. Is that realistic? Probably not. We're going to have people that put our officers into positions that they have to act to protect life. So we're going to have more officer-involved shootings. It's a fact of the business. And even if we think to ourselves, hey, let's get rid of guns altogether in the United States. If you want to take that approach, there's still going to be bad guys, and bad guys are still going to want guns. And so they're going to still use them and bring them to bear on the citizens of the United States to scare them, to intimidate them, to, rob from them, whatever it is. The bad guys are going to go get guns. They're going to have them. We're going to encounter those bad people. And we're going to have to end the situation as quickly as possible. And sometimes that's bringing a firearm to bear. So we want that same goal. Is it realistic? No. There are other things that are more mandated, like laws and such by the state that are out of our control that need to be changed at the state level in order to affect the change that they want. I can't think of anything right offhand, but there are some state laws that we've looked sure. at that when we break it down in these meetings, and that's the beauty of this, is that we can come together and say, okay, the reason we're doing this is because this is what's mandated by law. This isn't something that we arbitrarily, as the police department, came up with. This is how we're supposed to conduct our business. That is mandated by the state. Well, now they can take that focus and that energy and say, this is something we need to change at the state level.
That was Detective Greg Wilking from the Salt Lake City Police Department. What's your opinion of Black Lives Matter? Tell us at KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW88.3, or feel free to email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of In the Hive at kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.